By the light of the moon, I gazed at that pale forehead, those closed eyes, those locks of hair trembling in the wind, and I said to myself, what I'm looking at is only a shell. What is most important is invisible. As his lips parted in a half smile, I said to myself again, what moved me so deeply about this sleeping little prince is his loyalty to a flower, the image of the rose shining within him like a flame within a lamp, even when he's asleep. And I realized he was even more fragile than I had thought. Lamps must be protected. A gust of wind can blow them out. And walking on like that, I found the well at daybreak. And the well the pilot discovers is no ordinary well. It's a magical well with a bucket and a pulley that sings as the bucket is lowered. Like the biblical story of Jesus at the well, it contains living water, the water of life. The pilot realizes that this water was something entirely different from ordinary nourishment. Quote, it was born of our walk beneath the stars, of the song of the pulley, of the effort of my arms. It did the heart good, like a present, like a gift. Suddenly, the pilot feels overwhelmed with grief. He begins to realize that the little prince is planning to leave him, to return to his star and his rose, and that he has made a private pact with the snake to end his suffering on earth and send him back exactly on his anniversary of having come to earth. The pilot tries to prevent this, tries to kill the snake who will do this dirty deed, but the little prince has outfoxed him, has already made his decision. It is the anniversary of his coming to earth. His star will be exactly above the spot when he came down to earth, and now he must go home, home to his rose. Once again, I felt chilled by the sense of something irreparable, says the pilot, and I realized I couldn't bear the thought of never hearing that laugh again. For me, it was like a spring of fresh water in the desert. The little prince can sense the pilot's fear, and so, in a repeat of his parting from the fox, where he had learned about the wheat fields, he reassures the pilot that their inevitable parting will be assuaged by a gift. It will be the gift of his laughter. What are you saying? Asks the incredulous pilot. The little prince explains, and it's the same explanation that the fox gave him. It has to do with an intermediate symbol, like wheat fields. Quote, my dear pilot, when you look up at the sky at night, since I'll be living on one of those stars, since I'll be laughing on one of them. For you, it will be as if all the stars are laughing. You'll have stars that laugh. And the little prince laughed again. And when you're consoled, everyone eventually is consoled, you'll be glad you've known me. You'll always be my friend. You'll feel like laughing with me, and you'll open your window sometimes just for the fun of it, and your friends will be amazed to see you laughing while you're looking up at the night sky. Then you'll tell them, yes, it's the stars. They always make me laugh. And they'll think you're crazy. It'll be a nasty trick I played on you. And he laughed again. And it'll be as if I had given you, instead of stars, a lot of little tiny bells that know how to laugh. 6 years later, as the pilot relates his story, he acknowledges that he has overcome a part of his great sorrow through the gift of the little prince, but only a part. He realizes that his great sadness was the inevitable price of loving somebody. As the fox had taught him, one runs the risk of crying a little bit if one allows oneself to be tamed. And he listened to the stars at night like 500 million little bells, and sometimes the little bells all changed themselves into tears. But nothing in the universe could ever be the same because the little prince had been there. And there were now wheat fields and laughing stars with that special invisible secret that only he and his little friend had shared. So if we translate this into psychological language, which is almost a sin, we would say that following trauma, the innocent life in us cannot continue unharmed unless it leaves its encapsulation, its planet, and enters the flow of life and suffering here below. Ultimately, this reconnection will result in a new sense of aliveness and healing, but the process will entail a capacity for sorrow, for great grief. This will require a growing capacity to feel our feelings. Like the pilot in our story, Barbara has become conscious of her little prince, had become conscious of her little prince, and had been reanimated by his presence. And true to Saint-Exupéry's story, she was also aware of a great sadness in giving up this immortal or absolute innocence and suffering the loss of her frozen landscape and its aboriginal people. Her innocence was now suffering experience and could not return to the immortal world where its life had been preserved yet frozen. There was a sacrifice in this that she was willing to make. This was the humanization of something divine and therefore felt like a loss. And part of the lesson Barbara and I were learning was that these two worlds had to remain separated, except for a symbolic link, wheat fields. This link between the worlds is life-giving, the blessed greenness, absolutely essential if the soul is to live in the world. And this possibility of aliveness wrapped in sorrow emerges when something more is glimpsed between the worlds, if that intermediate space has been quickened by human love. The little prince in our story is an emissary of this love. He is a child negotiating between the worlds of innocence and experience, a divine child who carries both worlds in himself as his own tragic and beautiful dual destiny. I don't have time tonight to tell you the many dreams that Barbara had over the course of her analysis, but towards the end of our process together, she had a dream that we both recognized immediately as a further commentary on the green monster dream. The dream was a simple image. Green tendrils of a plant are waving in the breeze, with an accompanying voiceover that says, "I am the true vine." Barbara knew in the dream that this phrase was biblical, but she didn't know who said it or where the verse was found. She had grown up with a perfunctory relationship to the church that her parents belonged to. Curious myself, after hearing the dream in session, I got up and went over to my bookcase where there was a large Bible concordance. I looked up vine in the concordance and was referred to chapter 15 in the Gospel of John. I read the passage aloud to Barbara. Jesus said, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine grower. Every branch that bears fruit, he prunes to make it bear more fruit. Just as the branch cannot bear fruit unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. If you abide in me, ask for whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. My Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you, so abide in my love. I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete." Barbara and I could feel a deep spiritual truth flooding into the space between us like a blessing. Although neither of us could grasp its full meaning, such moments of mystery are by no means common in the psychoanalytic process, but they do occur, and this fact is not often noted in the literature of psychoanalysis. Shelley Alahante is an exception. She notes that such experiences are both beautiful and painful all at once. Quote, "The powerful feelings of love, reverence, and awe expressed in beautiful, intimate exchanges with patients, such as the ones I've just described, inspire in us both exquisite pleasure and exquisite pain." She further speculates that that exquisite pleasure and pain is why these experiences are not reported. This is what Barbara and I felt as she told her dream and I read the biblical passage. In that moment, the wisdom of the psyche came into full view for both of us. It was as though the benedicta veritas, the blessed greenness, had settled over us both, blessing us and filling the third space between us with a beauty and a mystery whose meaning could only be sensed and felt, not fully known. Looking back, and with the benefit of hindsight, and this is my conclusion, we might approach the meaning of Barbara's dreams with the following reflections. The Psyche was clearly making a statement here by superimposing the green tendril of the vine, identified as Christ consciousness, with the bright green tentacle of the green monster as it reached out to touch its soon-to-be lost blanket baby with its wrapped content and endangered cub. How might we understand this? Remembering that the green monster is a kind of shepherd who wanders his planet looking for endangered life forms in order to bring them back for transport to Earth so that he can be saved, we are immediately struck by the parallel associations in the biblical account that identify Christ as a shepherd. In John's Gospel, Jesus is spoken of as the Good Shepherd, in 1 Peter as the Chief Shepherd, and in Hebrew as the Great Shepherd. All references to his compassionate caring for the lost sheep among his people. These references also allude to the innocence of the lambs that any good shepherd saves and protects after the new lambs are born in the spring. Christ is also the innocent one, unblemished by sin, whose loving, compassionate attitudes towards children and their innocence is shown in several biblical passages. The Christian story referenced by Barbara's green tendril dream is centrally concerned with this process of preservation of the innocent child who is capable of love, in Margaret Arden's phrase. And yet, in that story, preservation is not enough. Once grown, the innocent child is destined to be sacrificed on the cross. I'm back in the Christian story now. A mythic theme that repeats itself in the animal sacrifice of all early cultures, where an unblemished, innocent, pure lamb must be chosen as a sacrifice to God. Here things get more complicated, but it won't be lost, perhaps, on you folks, that the main theme of our story in The Little Prince, at least the way we're interpreting it, is the sacrifice of innocence, its descent into this world, and then its voluntary death at the instigation of the snake. Here, a personal question that's always vexed me growing up in a Christian community is maybe relevant. I've often wondered why dogmatic Christianity has always insisted on Christ's innocence and his death on the cross, other than the ostensible rationale of the Pauline epistles in the later church, that only in this way could he die for our sins. You're familiar with this theology? And thus relieve us of the hellfire and damnation of a punishing God who would otherwise kill us, but now didn't have to. His bloodlust was slaked, so to speak. This idea of God as a bloodthirsty cannibal and of Christ as our proxy always seemed absolutely preposterous to me. If we tried to find a psychological meaning to that dogma, as Jung suggested we should, in other words, if we could try to find our way to an understanding of this peculiar pairing of innocence and crucifixion in this Christian story, what might it portend? Could it be that maybe the deep truth embedded in these rituals might be that we cannot apparently become fully human until we can accept the human condition, namely our mortality, and that this is more difficult than we thought? The difficult part being that we must let the innocent, God-identified part of us suffer experience in order to grow a soul? This would mean letting ourselves be tamed and facing the grief and the loss that accompanies such an event, anticipating all this grief and choosing it anyway. With the realization that we are all going to lose whatever we love in this life, and that there is a terrible sadness to this, one that requires compassionate mediation through love and the experience of beauty and art, we come to appreciate why trauma survivors often refuse the sacrifice and try to keep their innocent enshrined on another planet, adrift in eternity. John Tarrant, whose beautiful book, The Light Inside the Dark, circles and circles around this difficult reality, puts it like this. We see a child running between the trees in twilight with his friend. He ignores the call to dinner, cannot help, cannot hear anything, cannot see anything but the sound and illumination of his happiness. While we know, we have seen the charts, that he will die of leukemia. At such a moment, we can find unbearable the juxtaposition of innocence and suffering to come, the thought that the happiness in question is entirely illusory. It is hard to have the grand view of the angel at the same time we have the intimate view of the boy who wants to run and run forever. We have to acknowledge that the child was happy, looking forward to a future that would not be his. We have to say that life itself is beautiful before we talk about outcomes. Everything we taste is snatched from death. Our responsibility is to taste it completely. We betray the angel's view because we must. Those we love die, yet we must eat, we must sing, we must love them anyway. That is our job. We may have the angel's view as well as the child's, but not instead of it. When we stop singing, it is our time, and we too go into the dark. So once we can accept this dual reality, the truth finally realized by both the little prince and the pilot in our story, we can get to the joy on the other side of it, the tragic beauty of being alive, wheat fields and star music. The Christian myth, together with layered meaning of Barbara's dream, seem to say that if we consciously, voluntarily, and ritually allow innocence to suffer experience, if we let ourselves be pruned, so to speak, it will lead to the indwelling of the soul and then to the resurrection of the body, provided that we live and abide in the vine. We come back then to the idea of the two worlds that we started with. In Barbara's situation, the divine world with its extraterrestrial energies, including the innocent soul-carrying child, had to be co-opted in the service of defense against the traumatic realities of living. This left a picture just like Freud described: inflation, malignant innocence, infantile omnipotence, neurotic suffering, all organized by a self-care system in order to avoid the impossible suffering of life and reality. But the numinous aura around the core of this innocence was not produced by the repression. The divine child or human divine soul within us is not an artifact of the defensive process, but the very thing the defensive process is protecting. And it is protecting it because it is sacred, the very core of our aliveness. For my patient Barbara and for all of us, the normal stress of therapy requires that the divine archetypal world be freed from its recruitment as a defense in order to perform its proper function of lightening our earthbound suffering with its redeeming presence. In the process, our neurotic suffering slowly gets changed, not into everyday misery, as Freud suggested, but into what Wordsworth called the still, sad, beautiful music of humanity. We take on a piece of the darkness of the world and carry it. This leads to enlightenment. Suddenly there's meaning, joy, and gratitude. A little prince comes into the desert of our lives and says, "Draw me a sheep." Thank you. Okay, we have time for questions.